Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
All right, folks, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucksters, what the fuck nicks? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is WTF, my podcast. Thank you for tuning in. If you're new here, welcome. If you're just hanging around, nice to see you again. Wherever you are, if you're digging snow, I hope I'm helping out. Maybe, perhaps, hopefully, by the time that you hear this, maybe you'll have that all done, or maybe some of it's melted away. But if I can be any assistance, if you're sitting at home alone, perhaps by candlelight because you have to, I hope that I am a comforting force in your life. I hope I'm distracting you. It's one of the things I actually miss it. I know it's probably hard for you to hear this, but I sort of miss that about the East Coast, that day where you wake up and there's this calm, there's this peace, there's this quiet, there's no way to get your car out, and there's just no way to see how it's ever going to thaw. And then you realize, like, well, this is all pretty right now, but pretty soon it's just going to turn into gross, gray, icy mud, crusty garbage, just things froze. Like, the days of thawing are really kind of, they're relieving, but quite disgusting on the road. But anyways, I hope you're okay and you made it through it. You know who I'm talking to. So, what's going on? Let's start. I will tell you this right now, right out of the gate. Michael Moore is my guest today. This conversation was recorded in November, and we held it until we were closer to the release of Michael's new documentary, Where to Invade Next. So I guess what I'm saying very plainly is you will not hear us talk about the current water crisis in Flint, Michigan. The true horror of that situation had not come to light at the time we recorded this conversation. And as you know, I'm sure Michael has plenty to say if he hasn't already about that. But this was done a little while back, but it's a good talk. Also, I want to mention here, because, you know, a lot of you didn't buy my book. That's fine. I mean, how much of me can you take? But I want to mention that the ebook of Attempting Normal is on sale for a limited time for $1.99. Everywhere ebooks are sold. So there's that. We got to talk about some shit. All right. Let me figure it out. Let me figure out how to talk about it. Now, the first time that I really sort of met or knew about Amy Schumer was probably 2011. And the situation was amazing because I didn't know her. I did not know her comedy. I was doing a live WTF at the now defunct Comics Comedy Club in New York, and we had broken up that night. There were two shows. We had the nerd show, and then we had the dirt show. This was my concept. So the second show was just going to be filthy comics, and on that show, I had booked Joe DeRosa, Kurt Metzger, Anthony Jeselnik, Robert Kelly, Dave Attell was closing, and that, you know, that is just an avalanche of honest, raw filth, you know, just beautiful, expressive, dirty dudes. And at that time, Amy was dating Anthony Jeselnik, and she was backstage, and I said to my producer, I'm like, you know, we should put her on. I mean, if she wants to go on at the end of this thing. Yeah, but part of me was like, you know, she immediately said, yeah, I'll go on. I said, you want to go on? Yeah, I'll go on. And this was, and I was going to use her to close with. And that is a murderer's row there, buddy. Who's saying is that? I see that around a lot, but it doesn't matter. And, you know, DeRosa, Metzger, Jeselnik, Kelly, Attell. And Amy said she would close. And I was astounded, you know, because there was part of me, I didn't know who she was. And I'm like, well, I mean, you know, can this chick handle this thing? You know, and you know, and I brought her out, And she just fucking killed. And it was amazing. And that was 2011. You know, she's the real fucking deal. She's a real fucking comic. No question. And then after the show, you know, I'd been given a little bit of money to pay, like $50, you know, to people, to the comics, you know, from comics. And, you know, we had, my producer Brendan and I were, you know, he was giving out the money and we went to give a tell his 50 and he said, you know what, give it to Amy. All right. So that obviously a kind gesture on behalf of Attell and, you know, a respectful gesture. But the point being, Amy Schumer is a real fucking comic. So here's the thing. All this fucking this onslaught of accusations, this momentum, this fucking mob attack on Amy Schumer. It's fucking ridiculous. It's just fucking ridiculous. So where does it come from? You know what? You know what is it? What is it really about? What is the real pattern here? Right? What is it? What is the real pattern? Three examples on a video of. I don't even. Here's why I'm talking about this. Not because it's my responsibility. I am a comedian and it does rile me, obviously. But I was dragged into it a bit because a few months ago on the episode with Aaron Draplin, episode 649, you know, I had watched Amy's special and she did a bit. And it was about, you know, about people coming, about everyone coming. Now, this is not, again, if you work dirty, you know, talking about cum is going to be part of your repertoire. I mean, fucking Lenny did it, right? Did you cum good? Did you cum? Did you cum good? I didn't steal that. I'm citing him. I watched her bit and I was like, oh, fuck. That's a lot like my bit. It's almost like the female side of my bit. Now, my immediate thought, and I'm just repeating myself because the episode that I did it on, 649 Aaron Draplin, was taken out of context, edited. The conversation I had was edited by some fucking monkey to sound like I accused Amy of stealing. And then Opie and Jim got duped by a troll. They played it on the air. I didn't think that Amy stole my bit. I was mad that we had a similar bit. That was it. There was no way either of us could have taken each other's bit. She lives in a different city. We don't work together. We're both headliners. I knew all this. I found out that we taped those specials a week apart. There was no way. But we don't live in the same world, really. We don't see each other. Now we both have a similar bit. So what? So what? There's no stealing. Everybody does come. The point is that some fucking monkey, to serve an agenda, edited my words to support his agenda. His agenda to accuse Amy of stealing. Now, there's a difference between, you know, justice and fucking annihilation, attack. It's a difference. Now, I know some female comics, Wendy Liebman, Kathleen Madigan, Tammy Pescatelli, you know, got mad at her and tweeted things and whatever. And they eventually, you know, I think all of them recanted or apologized because it's fucking ridiculous. But that gave a foundation to what's happening now. And what is happening now? Is it about justice? Who's really attacking Amy Schumer? I watch those fucking videos. Yeah, I'm a comic. If you're a comic and this meme has driven into your skull and you're actually sitting there going, I think she did it, then you're a fucking amateur or you're bitter or you don't like her. The tabloid media, I mean, they're complicit out of desperation and you can't expect them to have a moral compass. So they support the fucking meme. The video goes out. Where does it come from? Who are those fucking people, right? So I watched your video, the first joke, the Wendy Liebman joke, whatever. It's a one-liner. Who gives a fuck? I mean, if somebody's really hanging on to a 20-year-old one-liner as being this essential part of her fucking oeuvre, that's crazy. One-liners are disposable. They're disposable. Nightly, writers who write monologues for fucking TV shows, they throw away 50 one-liners a day. A genius like Dave Attell has thrown away more one-liners than most of us have ever written. Attell's hilarious. It becomes impossible to sort of vet this stuff, is my point. As a comic, that one-liner about, you know, I like when men pay, whatever, anyone could have written that. Any woman could have written that. Any comic could have written that. That's just the truth of it. If you write, you write, you write. The you know, your point of view, you write to your point of view. She's a woman, they're women, and that's, you know, it was easy. This is not theft. It's just a matter of time. It's just a one-liner. It means nothing. Does not define Amy. Doesn't define Wendy. You know, that has nothing to, if that joke didn't exist with either of them, who cares? They're still who they are. They're entertainers or comics. Not theft. The second bit, the Kathleen Madigan bit, a similar idea became a sketch on Amy's show. Shows are written by committee. There's a group of writers in the room. Someone come up with an idea. That was the idea. Even I guarantee you, even if somebody said, yeah, I think I heard a similar joke about this, but it wasn't the same thing. It was about Oprah Winfrey paying somebody. Even if that came up, I don't know whose joke it was. There's a real good chance that they would be like, it's different. You know why? Because it is different. It's a sketch. It was executed. It was a piece of film. It was orchestrated, composed sketch with many beats. That idea is not owned, for fuck's sake. Not theft. It's just stupid. The Pescatelli thing, I don't even know what that, what was that about? Women with thin eyebrows? Well, just making that joke in junior high school. It's just, they're not anything. They're not, none of them are mystifying original observations, really. They're just not. Amy Schumer's a comedian. It becomes impossible to vet mundane material based on observations. It becomes very difficult. There are thousands of fucking comics churning out jokes every fucking day, everywhere. The people that I've spoken to, the people that I've met in this business that have been accused of joke theft, I truly believe that most of them have no idea that they're stealing them. The amount, that's not an apology for the ones that have certainly been guilty of stealing swaths of material. But in terms of one-liners or little ideas like that, I mean, are you fucking kidding me? Comedians absorb what's coming in and they process it. We've all been in the rooms of stand-up comedy clubs for most of our lives, hours and hours. And now the thing is in order to vet a joke against the history of recorded comedy on album or on television, it's fucking impossible. And this is not an apologist position. This is just a reality. All you can do is like, ah, that sounds a little familiar. Maybe I had to, you know, hold off on that. It just becomes impossible to vet everything, especially little ideas. I mean, Attell's hilarious. Attell is like one of the most prolific joke writers in the world. And there are a few of us, you know, sometime, you know, back in the day. I mean, I think I've talked about this here before. Once or twice a year, maybe you'll get a call from Attell and he'd be like, hey, do you do a bit about jerking off in the Bible? I'm like, no. He's like, oh, I thought, all right. Yeah, I mean, what are you going to do? You come up with an idea. You know, that's an original idea. Jerking off in the Bible is pretty specific. And I'm flattered that he thought maybe that I might have done a bit about jerking off in the Bible. But if you come up with a thing, an observational thing or a bit about, you know, something that we all experience, how are you going to vet that? It's not even that it's hack. It's just we all share the same reality. And if you're a comic and you're thinking funny, the possibilities of a lot of people doing similar jokes around things that we all fucking do, or things that are sort of our point of view related, is high. Have you watched fucking network sitcoms? Do you watch the monologues that happen every fucking night on nightly talk shows? Where's the outrage about the repetition of current event jokes or the repetition of sitcom plots? I mean, come on. This is fucking comedy, for fuck's sake. So, what is the pattern? What is the real pattern? It's certainly not a pattern of Amy stealing jokes. That it doesn't exist. So what is it? Well, I'll tell you. I had a thing on this on my website on WTFpod.com. And there used to be a comment board, just an open comment board. Now, this is true shit. You know, and sometimes, you know, I get, you know, people say I don't have enough women on the show, but I have as many women as I can get. The point is, I had an open comment section. that I had to shut down. Now, it's changed now. Now you have to, if you want to comment on WTFpod.com, you have to, you know, go through Facebook. So you have to identify yourself. It's a little harder to be anonymous when you have to post through Facebook. But before we did that, without fucking fail, if we had a woman guest, doesn't matter who it was or what she did, if there was a woman guest on this show, the comment section would blow up with fucking douchebags attacking that woman with just fucking garbage, slander, violence, just nasty shit. Just a fucking string of anonymous fucking monsters slinging garbage at any woman guest. So what is that about? That was the pattern. You know what I mean? So then you start looking at this attack, you know, this fight for justice, this sort of righteous idea that you're going to police comedy and call out joke thieves. So that means that there's some fucking dude, and they're all dudes. Look at it. They're all fucking dudes who champion this thing. So where's all this outrage coming from? Look at it. Look at it. Poke around a little bit. They're all dudes. They're all fucking dudes. And they're all saying the same fucking thing. It's got nothing to do with justice. This is about fucking annihilating a woman, annihilating a comedian, but it's about annihilation. It's got nothing to do. Here's what happens is that they find this portal. It happened with the Gamergate thing too, but they find this portal. You know, Amy was vulnerable. So they exploited that vulnerability by trying to make a case and putting a lot of work into this case, to the point where they manipulated some of my words to suit their agenda and get that through, to try to make that meme happen. So they push and they push and they push. So now this fucking video is out there. Now this meme is out there. So now the portal is open. So who the fuck are these people? It's my belief that what's really happening is that there is this mob momentum. There is this consensus built. These guys, they have leaders. They know who their leaders are. They all share the same ideology. They have leaders because they're too weak not to have leaders. And they all think the same. What is happening with Amy has nothing to do with justice. It has nothing to do with comedy. What's happening is that this is the real pattern, is that she, through the internet and through video, is literally being verbally career raped by an army of unfuckable hate nerds. They play video games all day, then they watch MMA, and then they spend the evening jerking off to deep throat gag porn, and then they wake up and they put a few hours in to shaming Amy, to verbally fucking abusing Amy. You read the comments. This is not about justice. This is about hate. Now look, I'm no fucking, you know, saint. You know, all fucking dudes, you know, have their sexist moments. All of us. Some of us are teachable. We all have our sexist moments. And hopefully we evolve out of that. But misogyny requires commitment. And it requires, in this case, a mob mentality of like-minded people. So this isn't about justice. Not in this case. This is about, it's about hate. It's about anger. It's about complete fucking woman bashing. And it's about this contingent of culture. A lot of them, if you go look at their Twitter feeds, a lot of them are Trump supporters because they like an authoritarian leader, because they service their hate and their fucking horrible fear and insecurity. Yeah, in terms of, you know, Amy's just a fucking comic. She's an entertainer and she's the real deal, whether you like her jokes or not. She's a real comic, but she's a woman, and these fuckers are trying to destroy her. These are specific people. But this momentum culturally is insanely dangerous, because what it does to creative people, or to people that are trying to put themselves out there, or to people that are trying to do new things and open up the minds and do that kind of stuff, is that we become fucking self-censoring and paranoid and crazy. And it becomes, sometimes it's sort of like, is it worth it? So if you're just an average dude, and this spreads throughout the culture, you know, where people are very quick to know it all, You know, like you can't write a sentence without somebody going like, oh, somebody said it. You know, so-and-so said the same thing. So it's a similar thing. So, you know, this need to one-up, this need to call, you know, foul, to call theft or whatever. All it's going to do eventually is completely stifle creativity. Now, obviously, plagiarism is bad when it exists, when it happens. Obviously, people profiting over other people's, you know, work, it's horrible. It denies people a living. But mostly, most of the time, it's just about stifling voices, shutting people down. And if these guys, the momentum that exists, the narrow-minded, hateful, frightened momentum of socially, emotionally, and psychologically, and morally compromised individuals wins, then it's fucking over. There's no progress. There's no creativity. There's no sort of moral compass. It's a fucking cultural malignancy. But the bottom line is, it's like, hey, either you think Amy's funny or you don't, but this is whatever's going on right now is not about justice or joke theft or anything other than a fucking army of unfuckable hate nerds panicking because they feel like what they represent in the world is diminishing and they can't adapt to progress. Like I said, you know, like even with my guest today, you know, Michael Moore, like I tweeted that I had him on and immediately people were like, no, no, fuck, I'm going to pass. It's very odd, you know, yeah, even as a liberal person, you know, Michael can be a little much. But the bottom line is that there's a pursuit of truth. That is what he represents. He doesn't represent the left or the right. It has nothing to do with that. At some point, either you want to make the reality what you think it should be, or you pursue the truth of what's happening. And if you support the garbage or untruth or systemic fucking problems because it fits your line of hate, then fine. It's, you know, you're free to have your opinion. But what Michael Moore really is as a documentarian, which is what he does, is somebody who was fighting for and looking for the truth and fighting for, you know, people to be able to earn a living properly, to live in a safe place, to have proper health coverage, to have an America that, you know, that works for everybody. Well, you know, look, I had this conversation again. This was before the Flint water horror, so we didn't get into that. You know, we didn't get into a lot of stuff, but yeah, I talked to him about, you know, who he is and about this new movie, which I liked a lot. The new movie is called Where to Invade Next. It's a very different approach to documentary than he's done before. It's a very clever conceit in terms of structure, and it was very powerful. So let's go now to my conversation with Michael Moore.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowerte-Dienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowerte-Dienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
What have you been doing? I mean, what have you been doing all day? Michael Moore in Hollywood. What are you doing? I mean, you're running around?
Yeah, I've been running around.
Ongoing narrative? Selling that movie?
No, the movie's sold.
It's, no, but you know what I mean? Getting people.
Oh, to get people to watch it?
Yeah.
Oh, they're going to come anyways, aren't they?
Yeah, of course.
I don't need to do any of that.
Of course.
Right?
People come because they love you and because they hate you both. You're one of these rare people.
Yeah. The haters have seemed to have died off or something. I don't know where they went. But,
well, I think they've got their own problems, Michael.
I think they're focused on themselves.
They're all hating each other, just imploding.
Well, yeah. Well, God bless them.
What have you done out here? What have you been doing?
Well, last night I came out here and there was a screening of my new movie for...
Where to Invade Next. I watched a screening. I had a small screening right here in the garage.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, for myself.
For just you?
Yeah, it was good. I enjoyed it.
Oh, thank you.
I don't want to ruin anything, but you seem to be softening a bit. It seems like your heart is getting more open and you're a little forgiving.
That's actually just the subversive part of this. It's really, I'm actually more angry.
Is that true?
And more, oh yeah, yeah, yeah. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to. I think the wolf in sheep's clothing method might be a little bit better here.
That was deliberate?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It was totally. I'm so upset at everything that's going on.
Yeah.
And I've tried for 25 years the hot poker in the eye effect.
Right.
And while that has, I think, brought a lot of people along, and it's been good and all that in appropriate moments. I think this time around, I thought, there's even a better way to try and reach an even wider audience, with this.
Oh, geez. You had me sold. I thought like, hey, you know, Michael Moore's got a little hope. He's got a little patience. What's happening? This movie feels
no,
uplifting.
I have no patience. I'm hopeless.
It's an illusion.
Here's what you may have picked up on a little bit. I am optimistic. Mm. I am in a crazy way optimistic. Yeah, right. I'm not a cynic. I don't sit back in my narcissism and just go, "Yeah, it's all fucked up." And
oh, really? You know. So there's a little room in your narcissism to have a little bit of optimism?
Yeah. There is like no. I need narcissism actually.
Of course.
If I actually spent a little bit of each day thinking about myself.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think I would have a better life. Frankly, I'm very much, look, I mean, I never expected to be doing this anyway, so this is all kind of a...
In general, you mean documentary?
In general, no. I hated documentaries. I always hated them.
Well, I think it's interesting that you say you should spend a little more time thinking about yourself, because I think some people think that you... And I actually had a conversation with a woman last night about this, that I was watching the movie. I enjoyed it. I said, I'm learning. I feel sad, but, Michael's carrying me through it, and she said that... She's in the film business. She said, well, he seems to make it about himself. And I said, well, he sort of has to. He has to run it through him. How right. else, you've become, like, you're very careful and it seems on some level relatively image conscious about your role in these movies.
Right, right. Yeah, when she says I make it about myself, it's just because I'm in the movie. I mean, it's like saying that Woody Allen, he's just always, it's always about him.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's Spike Lee. He's just always in his movies.
Right.
That's, some of us do that. I mean, it's a way of storytelling.
Yeah,
but
of course.
It's not because in my case that I, come on, let's be, I mean, look, I'm not that self-loathing on one level, but on another level, it's like if you were me, you wouldn't want to see yourself blown up 50 feet on a movie.
No, I think
screen.
there's a humility to it, and it's a way of it's disarming, and it's a way you approach the subject matter, and also runs through you. You're like the fact that you're telling me you've tempered your rage to. I guess in looking at that film, you sort of had to, because you had to act like a human. You weren't running around America. You were running around other people's countries and politely engaging them
right.
with stuff you wanted to learn.
Well, because I threw down a challenge to myself
right.
in the idea of this movie. The conceit of this movie is, how can I make a movie that goes at the heart of everything that's wrong in this country,
mm-hmm.
everything that's all messed up about America, but never shoot a single frame of film or video in this country? I make a movie about the United States and never go to the United States.
And how did you develop it? Was it you woke up sweating and said, I got it? Or was
No,
it?
I've been thinking about this since I was 19. Ever since I got a Eurail pass and a youth hostel card and went to Europe with a backpack and wandered around for 2 months.
You were there for 2 months?
Yeah.
And what was your temperament then?
I remember thinking I would be in a country and I would notice something. I mm-hmm. just, and I would go, how come we don't do that?
Mm-hmm.
That's such a good idea.
Right.
Or I would hear about how, college is entirely free. Or I remember I was hiking in Sweden and busted my foot.
Yeah.
And had to go to a hospital or a clinic.
Panicked.
And
they, right, you're probably panicked. Like, oh my god,
I don't have my Blue Cross card. I'm going to be right. What is going to happen to me here? Yeah. And they're like, they fix me up and they go, okay, have a nice day, or however you say that in Swedish.
You send the bill.
And I'm there's no bill. Yeah, I was like, you've got to be kidding me. It's the first time I'd ever heard that.
That you're like, I think I'll stay
healthcare
here.
Was free. Yeah, I was like, wow. So over the years.
But wait, before we go there, how politicized were you at that time? When because you said that you never thought you'd be doing this. And
I never thought I'd be making a documentary because I didn't like documentaries.
In general, but you've made like a half dozen or 10 of them.
Yeah. Yeah. I've made nine films now.
But so where did it start? You grew up in outside of Flint.
Yeah. Flint, Michigan. Right.
And you then, were, your dad,
dad was an auto worker. My mom was a secretary.
How old are you now?
I'm now 61.
Okay.
61.
So you're an honest to God baby boomer.
Yeah, I'm a baby boomer, and
you witnessed the 60s.
Saw the 60s, 70s, and
you remember Nixon from junior high, maybe?
I remember Nixon. I remember campaigning for Nixon, actually.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
With your dad?
No. I was in ninth grade, and no, my dad voted Democrats or Irish.
Always,
Catholic.
Right.
But I was so against the war in Vietnam and Johnson and Humphrey and all of that with the war. And it was 68.
Uh-huh.
And I just thought, I'm not going to do anything to help those guys. And what can I do to help the other guy? That's eighth grade. So I didn't really know who Nixon was,
So just, who awakened you to the realities of the politics of the war in eighth grade? How did you take
that? I don't know. I just watched the news and I just started developing my own ideas.
No older
thoughts.
Brothers?
No.
No.
Oh, no.
No guy at the record store?
No, no, no. No priest in the rectory.
No cool priest, the hip liberal priest?
There was actually a hippie priest that was pretty cool. And I think probably, yeah, I went to Catholic school. So there were those nuns and priests who were very much on the left side of things. And they thought the war was wrong and they were very much in favor of civil rights and things like that. So
those are important.
That probably had a big influence. I had a cousin, too, who lived in New York City. And my mom's sister had moved to New York way, way back when she was young, married a man who was a state assemblyman, Democrat, part of the Roosevelt machine. And she would come, our cousin would come every summer to visit us.
Is it a woman or a man?
A man. Oh, I mean, no. The uncle was a man in the state assembly. Our cousin's a woman.
Yeah.
And then she would teach us all this stuff about the Kennedys and Democrats and all that.
Inside line.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And then when we would go there to New York to visit, they lived on Staten Island. And so we would stay there for, a month. And take the ferry over and got to see, and experience and know and learn about New York and that whole thing when we were starting in probably, I was, 8 years old.
So. Was that in the late 60s?
It was 1963.
Oh, so it hadn't fallen yet. New York was still pretty glorious.
Oh, yeah. No, it's a great place. Yeah. I mean, literally, and we would take, us kids would just take the ferry by ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Over there and just wander around.
Sure.
Get on the subway.
Yeah, it was still like the Mad Men era.
Right. Yeah. I remember standing outside the Ed Sullivan Theater, which wasn't called the Ed Sullivan Theater then. It was just where the Ed Sullivan Show was.
Right.
And with our little autograph books, because we're from the Midwest, so we had these little autograph books. And I remember standing there waiting to get Roy Rogers' autograph.
Roy Rogers!
Yeah, that was a big moment for me.
Did you get it?
Yeah, yeah. His and Dale. His wife, Dale Evans.
How about the horse?
Trigger was not there.
They can fit him in that theater. I'm surprised he didn't bring him.
Yeah, he might have been dead by that time and already
Trigger?
Stuffed.
Oh, that's too bad.
Yeah.
All right, so you're growing up. Did you have any fun?
When I was growing up?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Were you a fun guy?
My sister and I were just talking about this the other night, how we used to stay out. So that was back in the day when the parents would tell you to go play in the street.
Sure.
It's the opposite now, the helicopter.
Go hang around the corner.
You went and hung out on the corner. You played baseball on the East Coast. You played stickball in the street.
Yep.
It was a dirt street that we lived on. So we were just dirty all the time. And
all the neighbors' kids would come out.
All the neighbors' kids. And then when it got dark, which in Michigan, because we're so far to the west, but we're in the eastern time zone. So it didn't get dark till 10 o'clock, but then we would stay out for another hour or so and play Bloody Murder.
And then you'd hear your mother yell. That's what I'd heard.
Mothers would yell. Yeah. 11 o'clock, they'd all yell.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, well, see, no, yeah, but the Catholic version, of the Irish version of that is, Michael Francis!
Yeah.
Michael Francis! I'm coming.
Yeah.
But no.
10 more minutes.
10 more minutes. Yeah. Bloody Murder! Uh-huh. We played Bloody Murder. That was our favorite game.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I remember that even in early 70s, 71, but I grew up in New Mexico. Mm. And I don't know that that neighborhood where I grew up is necessarily any different, but yours changed a lot.
Yeah. Yes, of course. Yeah, because back then everybody had a job and they had a good job. They had mm-hmm. a good factory job. They were all union guys. And, you know, they made good money. And
how old were you when that fell apart? How old were you when you saw your father or the, your neighborhood or your city go through that heartbreak?
It started when Reagan got elected, basically. It started around 1980. And so by that time, I was 26 years old. So I was beyond it. And I quit my first day at General Motors. I could not.
How old were you?
I was right out of high school.
So and you went where your dad got you the gig or
no,
what?
No, my buddy, his dad was, had a white collar job there. So they were hiring and he could get us applications and we right. got in and we both got hired. And the first day I got up and I could smell the cigarettes from downstairs. My dad was already up getting ready to go to his job in the yeah. factory. And I just laid there in bed and I just thought, oh God, I do not want a life of this. I just right. do not want to get up at 4:30 every morning and go build cars.
But that first cigarette's great. And I'll tell you that right now. I miss those fuckers.
Yeah, yeah.
I never
smoked, so I don't know.
That's so funny. The kid of a smoker goes either way. Either you're going to do it or you're never going to do it.
Yeah, no. The parents, my dad and his parents, his dad, they smoked a lot. So you just had that smell on you all the time.
Yeah,
and,
yeah. It's weird. I you're talking about it in sort of a slightly negative tone. I'm thinking. About like what a great
right
home.
Now is
what,
your yeah. sensory your memory
yeah, yeah, yeah.
is
I'm like
it's
oh.
like the perfume of
well,
it,
yeah everything smelled like cigarettes for years
yes, right.
people forget that every nightclub everywhere you yeah. went smelled you smoked on a plane
right
I don't
you
know
smoked
how the fuck
smoked
did
in a theater
when did I don't know how we ever lived with it
yeah no it was everywhere you're right
it's
it was,
crazy I
it
remember
was,
in, when I was in high school smoking on a plane
right
in the back
right
the last four rows
right.
as if that's not going to affect the
I know
economy.
You smelled it through the whole plane yeah
unbelievable so all right so what was your plan then when you decided that wasn't for you
I didn't have one and I had enrolled in the local college and I lasted about a year and a half and I went for
studying
the,
what
I was studying political science and theater. And
so you had some aspirations to act?
Yeah, or write,
uh-huh.
you know, write plays, something like that.
Did you write any?
Yes, I did, actually. I wrote a play during that year and a half, and it won a prize at the University of Michigan.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
What was it about?
Yeah. It was about, it was sort of an avant-garde piece where...
Took some chances.
Well, essentially, it ends up with this guy looking like Jesus on a cross made of aluminum foil, and Jesus is kind of upset at what all his followers are doing, and so he pulls the nails out of the, you think it's just a cross with like Jesus yeah. on it dead, but he pulls the nails out and he comes off the cross and starts confronting the audience for their behavior. And then I had actors placed in the audience to stand up and start shouting, "Get back up there! Get back up there!
Wow!
Damn you, Jesus!"
Satire chops and, in place already.
And then a guy runs out of the audience mm-hmm. with a God. You could never do this now, right?
Well, maybe
a guy
you could.
Runs out of the audience with a gun, leaps on the stage and shoots Jesus, and then drags him back to the cross.
Wow!
And then there's people there, and they decide they help. Put the dead Jesus now back up on the cross.
That this was I don't think your comedy chops were in place yet.
It was funny at the beginning.
Right. I know I thought it was funny the idea of them telling to get back up on the cross.
But
you took it all the way.
Well, the play was really was trying to say that essentially some Christians like their Jesus dead.
Yeah.
And on a cross.
Sure. Well, I mean, that's what they've grown up with. I mean,
yes.
It's a hard thing to wrap your brain around
if they
otherwise.
Actually had to live what he said to do, to love your neighbor, to do good to those who persecute you, to turn the other cheek, to that the poor get into heaven before anybody else. You know, if they actually had to live that life.
Or yeah. even really process those things philosophically, which is, I thought, was interesting about the film, is that, you know, people were speaking about the nature of brotherly love, of community, of you know, pride in the people of your country,
yeah,
in a way that was collaborative, mm-hmm, and respectful,
yeah,
without talk of religion or Christianity at all.
Right.
It was second nature.
Yeah.
That was a very fascinating thing, that when you were talking to the people in, I think, Sweden and Norway, mm-hmm, that there was not...
In Norway, yeah.
In, mm-hmm, Norway, that, you know, the type of vengeful justice and also the type of selfish, self-serving individualism that is really what drives this country, and the greed, it doesn't even register to them.
Right.
That's
no.
fascinating.
No, they... Like they said, they organize themselves around the concept of we, and we organize ourselves around the concept of me.
Yeah.
I'll take care of me, you take care of you.
But was that always the way? I mean, do you see, it seems to me that on some level with what your sense of justice is and what your sense of how things should be, do you remember a time where it was closer to that? Do you have some fond memory? Do you believe there was an America that functioned properly at a time in your life?
For white people.
Well, yeah I get
sure.
that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think, yes, of course. I think back when I was growing up, the sense of community the people had, how they felt and treated each other, you know, in the community, in the neighborhood, you mm-hmm. would take care. You could leave the house and the neighbor would look after the kids. Now you don't even know the neighbor's name two doors down from you. You know, it's that sort of thing. It's we do live in a different world like that.
There's a lot of weird detachment, Michael. And it's like, and I don't know, it's sort of a benign evil in the way that I don't know that people even know they're doing it. It doesn't seem to be necessarily malice in it, but there seems to be sort of like you see shit go down and people like in some of these videos you see of like those cops taking that kid out of that desk and throwing that kid yeah. to the ground yeah. that the other students didn't even look up.
Yeah. Right.
That there was.
They just know that's the normal.
Uh-huh.
That's the normal to them. And so it wasn't unusual. And then later we find out he was nicknamed Officer Slam.
Right.
I mean, that's what they called him in school.
It's interesting that this movie, you were able to really cover everything that you've been working towards and for your entire career on film. That you were able to cover it all with yeah. this context that you created by going to other countries.
That's pretty true. Yeah,
you're able to cover, you know, corporate crime, mm-hmm. you're the corporate greed. You're able to cover guns,
healthcare,
mm-hmm. prison,
yeah.
race,
yeah.
Education,
the banks.
The banks. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and just a sense of human dignity and human rights and
right.
union rights and employee right. rights. It was like all of this was like your masterwork.
Yeah.
And you chose to be more diplomatic in this one.
Well, again, I'm not being diplomatic. I'm up to something here. I'm up to something very subversive because I expect revolution to happen.
Right.
And I expect this film to play a role in that.
Well,
I believe that there's so many things percolating just below the surface right now
mm-hmm.
that people are so pissed off about. And it's just waiting to happen. And some of
and
it's
you're
already
just hoping it happens in the right direction.
It will happen in the right direction. It will happen.
This is the optimism.
Yes, this is and I have historical backup. There are examples of when the people have risen up, it hasn't gone the right way. And we know that from the last century. But I don't think that's what's going to happen now, because I think, especially the younger generation, that we've raised a bunch of kids that are not haters. I mean, they don't hate somebody because they're in love with somebody from the same gender.
Right.
You know, they just don't, they're
more open-minded.
They're much more open-minded. And the sort of the older generation that was full of this racism, and I'm not saying there isn't racism. We obviously have a lot of racism, but still that is, I see it leaving. It's going, you know?
Well, yeah, sure. I think that a lot of the type
and the Republicans are essentially that noise you hear from that crazy campaign that's going on.
Yeah.
They sound like the dying dinosaurs must have sounded. You know, this is sort of weird noises yeah. they're emitting because they know they're done.
Reptilian death throes.
They're over.
Yeah.
No, and I mean, statistically, they're over.
Yeah.
Right now, the statistic is just, it blows my mind. 81.5% of the electorate in this country is either women, people of color, or young people between the ages of 18 and 35. That's 81.5% of the country. 18.5% of the country are white guys over the age of 35. Yet to hear the Republicans talk, they think whenever they say the word America, yeah. that's the America that they're talking to. That isn't America anymore. That 2 months ago, first day of kindergarten in September, first time ever in our history where the majority of kindergartners were not white. It has changed. We live in a different America.
And there's also a contingent of that 18% that is very aware of that and very angry about it.
Absolutely. Are you? I mean, did you go to college? Sure. Where'd you go?
Boston University.
So you went to a private university.
Yeah.
But even then, it probably wasn't $70,000 a year.
Look, I was, my parents had a little bread and I didn't ask questions, Michael.
Should I ask any now?
No. I mean, I did all right. I mean, I don't know what the exact cost of it was, but, you know, I was afforded that luxury because, you know, my dad was a doctor, and I didn't grow up in want of much.
Okay. Well, if you had gone to a SUNY school in New York,
yeah,
if you'd gone to UC Berkeley or Santa Barbara or whatever, you would have paid $0. Ann Arbor, University of Michigan. I think I went a year and a half to the University of Michigan in Flint. I think I might have paid $500 a semester.
So there was a time in this country where public education through college was doable. And that's another thing you talked about.
It was a value. It was a value that young people should be able to go post-secondary education, go to college, and not end up at a debtor's prison at the age of 22.
Right.
That was so that at 22, when you had your education, you could then take the time to decide what you wanted to do with your life.
Yep.
Maybe you didn't want to go to work right away. No problem. Maybe you want to go backpacking around Europe. No problem. Maybe you want to fall in love. Maybe any of a number of things. Now you've got to get to work right away to pay off these student loans.
And it's not even clear that what you took from the college experience can help you at all in any way.
Well, it doesn't. Everybody knows that.
Well, right. But like when we were younger and even when I was in college, I mean, there was a strong liberal arts education available. There was still the structure of the education was still to sort of broaden your horizons on a lot of different levels, creativity, right, and otherwise, and you could choose those things.
Yes, you could take poetry classes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you could take things that they would say now is, how's that going to get you a job?
It doesn't get you a job anyways. That's a weird thing. They're just shutting it all down to make these mills of, to create drones that are really incapable of much.
And by creating drones, then we're not going to come up with the next invention, the next great cure for something we need a cure for, or the next piece of great art. I mean, and that's, think about that,
and
too.
A lot of people don't think that's important. That was another interesting thing in the movie, you know, that note where, you know, it was an aside, but you're walking through the maximum security prison. Where was that, Norway?
In Norway,
and there's modern art on the walls.
It was mind-blowing. It was mind-blowing.
So, okay, let's go back to you and modern art. So, you killed Jesus with a gun as a playwright.
Won an award at the University of Michigan. Yes.
Yeah, well, it was gutsy. What did your Catholic parents think of it? Did they come to the show?
They didn't come to the show. But I explained it enough to them to where they understood that I was trying to show the good Jesus and that the haters would not like it if he was walking amongst us today. They got that.
How Catholic did you grow up?
Very Catholic. My parents went to Mass every single day of their lives.
Really?
7 days a week, yes. And I asked them at 14 years old if I could leave home and go to the seminary to be a priest. And they did not want me to go, but all you had to do was tell them that, you know, you had a calling.
right.
Even though I didn't believe in that.
Sure.
But I wanted to, I was very, remember the time now we lived in, the Berrigan brothers. These were two Catholic priests. They were brothers.
Tom and, what was the other one?
Phil and Dan Berrigan.
Oh, Phil and Dan.
Phil and Dan Berrigan.
I think Tom Berrigan is a writer.
And, or a member of KISS. I'm not sure which, but anyways, they were the anti-war priests.
Right.
They were arrested, for, you know, pouring their blood over draft records. There was Cesar Chavez and the farm workers movement, mm-hmm. which was very Catholic based, on the priests that were involved in that movement. So I was very much drawn to how, being a priest could actually do good in this manner.
Mm-hmm.
And so I convinced him to let me leave home at 14, and I went away to the seminary.
You did?
Yes, I did.
For how long?
Just 1 year. The hormones kicked in.
And, not cut out for it.
I read the rule book. At that time, it just said no girls. Of course, they actually meant no girls or boys.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
It's somewhere between the age of 14 and 15, I thought, wow, there's another gender, they look good.
Yeah, yeah. You might have even been a year late on that one.
No, I remember going in and telling. I remember I was in science class, and the priest that was teaching science class, and I remember saying to him, so Father, so God created everything in 6 days, and on the sixth day He created man, you know, like Adam, and made Eve from Adam with a rib.
Yeah,
and I don't know about that, Father, because It looks like to me God spent about 23 hours of that day on women and about an hour on us. I mean, you know, they look at women. They're like, they're, you know, they score higher on the tests.
Sure.
They live 3 years longer.
He was thinking ahead. He's like, we need the women to be ahead of the curve here.
They live longer. They have two X chromosomes. Mm. We're missing one piece of that second X chromosome, which we call now a Y, but it's missing that fourth quadrant.
Right. And that's also something that was in this film, that conversation with those female CEOs in Norway, you know, about, you know, the former, what was she, the president?
Yeah, the president of Iceland.
Of Iceland, that's right. It was in Iceland, right, the women CEOs. About
first, you know, country to elect a woman president,
and also that the women salvaged the economy.
Yes,
after the bankers destroyed it.
Yes,
and that there's this interesting, you know, balance and respect and equality that it's very clear to the men there too. It seems that, you know, women are really should be running things.
Well, isn't it odd that we don't have more women running things, or that we prevent them from running things? Because go back to when you were a child, who ran the house?
Well, that's always been this sort of weird.
Who took care of the checkbook?
The weird excuse of patriarchy is they're secretly running things. We don't need to let them run things.
Oh, yeah, right.
You know what I mean?
What a bunch of bullshit. Well, it's a way to then you don't have to pay them, or you pay them very little.
And it was the way they respected them. It was right. Like, well, we know they're really wearing the pants.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, in fact, actually, the women in Iceland, I show this in the film, went on strike in 1975.
Yeah.
And it shut the country down. And not just the country, in terms of nothing worked, but they wouldn't work in the home either. They went on this, like, women's strike. And so, you know, nobody was making dinner. Nobody was doing the laundry. Mm-hmm. And it flipped the men out. And actually, in a good way, sensitized them to the fact of, wow, if it weren't for women, things would be pretty bad.
And also, you shot in Tunisia, which had a similar situation, I think, after that.
Yes. Well, the women there wanted an equal rights amendment to their constitution, like the women in this country.
And this is a Muslim country.
It's a Muslim country. The Islamic Party opposed it, but the people of the country wanted it, and they voted it in. Mm. And now they have all these equal rights provisions in their constitution for women that we don't have in our constitution.
Well, I found it fascinating because I'm guilty of what that Tunisian woman was, you know, talk in her appeal to the people of the United States, that you gave a few people the opportunity, if you have anything to say.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that's a tough position for someone to be in,
right,
in a way. But, you know, when she said, you know, we all know you, why don't you get to know us?
Right.
And, you know, I'm guilty of that. And it is sort of fascinating to me. And I don't even know much about England.
Right.
You know what I mean? But
right,
there is a whole world out there.
You don't know something about the country next door to you.
No, Canada? Or Mexico?
Yeah, or Mexico. We're in California here.
Yeah, yeah.
We're a few miles from Mexico. Yeah. Who's the president of Mexico?
That guy.
Yeah, exactly. And you're an educated person. Yeah. You went to Boston.
Do you know who he is?
No, I don't know who it is.
Thank God. All right.
I know. No. I'm not saying like I'm smarter than you. I'm like, or now we know Trudeau, just guy. That's a name everybody knows
sure.
in Canada.
But the reason I know it is because his wife fucked Mick Jagger.
Right, exactly. But the guy. Well, but who's been the Prime Minister of Canada for the last
crack
decade?
Crack smoking guy.
Yeah, that was the mayor of Toronto.
Oh,
his name was Stephen Harper.
Yeah.
He ran Canada for
the last
decade.
He's a bad guy. Yeah. They all hated him.
Yeah. But I'm just saying, we don't know anything about anybody in the world, including the people who live next door to us.
In the last few years, you know, I've so thoroughly detached from the political circus that I'm hard pressed to know exactly what's going on now. I don't know that I've gotten cynical. I've just gotten more self-involved.
In what way? What do you mean by that?
Well, I made a fairly, you know, clear decision to deal with, you know, my own kind of existential, you know, struggles emotionally and otherwise, you know, around my own rage and, you know, my own sort of perception of things, and talk about that on a day-to-day basis. Mm-hmm. So, like, I went in instead of out after Air America, and a lot of people relate to it.
No, I think this is the because you've taken that path, it's been so much more enlightening than when you were on Air America, when you had to play a role on the liberal radio network. No. This, your podcast and now your show on TV, this is a very engaging. It's like you can't stop listening. You can't stop watching it because you figured out in the way that you were saying about, you know, and I had to say to you, no, this is maybe I'm more angry than ever, even though I look like I'm being diplomatic and nice. But I've just found a way to channel that rage in a way where I want things to happen in my lifetime. I want them to happen for me, my neighbors, you, the people that live across the pond, whatever. And I think you've done a similar thing. And you may call it not political, but it might actually be more political because
humanizes and people start to appreciate each other.
Yes, and I think that that goes a long way to making the world a better place. Yes. And I know you're not doing this for that altruistic, cliched reason. But,
right.
But Mark, I mean, just let's just, can we, do we have a split screen here on the radio? No, but I'm just saying, put old Mark up against current.
Well, yeah, well, that's why I thought, like, you know, I've started to soften a bit and be a little more like,
I don't think it's softening,
but empathetic or open-hearted. That's
not, why do we call that? Why is that softening?
Well, no,
I meant it
in a good way, but I know.
Yeah, but being empathetic and going inward like that, that is aggressive in a way, because we're not supposed to do that.
Mm.
We're supposed to keep up the armor and the shield and like,
keep working
and rah,
get yours. You know,
and how come you're not doing 100 dates on the road this year?
Yeah, I know.
You know, it's like, no, I don't think so. Because, you know.
I've been saying that a lot lately.
Yeah, no, I think that there's a positive effect to it.
But I think that's something you might have gotten, you know, before it became too filled with bile, that being part of a Catholic upbringing, if you frame it philosophically in the correct way, it is an empathetic disposition. I like profoundly.
Yes, but also being brought up in that Catholic way. I mean, anybody listening to this who was raised Catholic, really super Catholic, big C Catholic, man, there's a lot going on.
Yeah, there's a hell.
there's a hell, you know.
And you know what happens there. There's a lot of burning and horrible things, and you believe it.
And you believe that the hell you're experiencing now is somehow you deserve it. You know, you must have done something to bring this onto yourself.
And, right.
And all of that. It's just, no, I think it's, but again, you know, it's funny, when I had my TV show. Which one?
The Awful Truth?
Both of them. Actually, this happened on both shows, on TV Nation and The Awful Truth. And we were in the writer's room one day, myself and the writers. And I don't know how we got onto the topic of religion, but it was kind of like, you know, I mean, you kind of knew who the Jewish writers were, and you knew a couple of the Catholics, but we just asked everybody, like, how were you raised and what religion? There wasn't a single Protestant in the room. They were all raised Catholic or Jewish. I thought, okay, there's like, so then when I did my second TV show, we did the same thing. There was one Protestant, and the rest, there was all, it was like Catholics.
Was he the showrunner?
Yes, actually. Yes. And his name was Jay Martell, and he went on to be the showrunner for Key and Peele. He's a very, very funny guy.
That's so funny. So
his dad was a preacher.
The self-flagellation necessary to become a writer only exists in Jews and Catholics.
Yeah. What is that? I think it's because I think we need to laugh. I think it's the flip side of the coin.
The relief, yeah.
The relief, because on that other side of the coin, we're actually quite angry.
Sure. And also it's a way to sort of maneuver through the world and have a voice. And you know, humor can be very powerful and cutting. It can be disarming, and it can be revelatory. I mean, it's a powerful
thing. And it also helps to deal with the personal pain.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Right? Oh, yeah.
I mean,
you don't want to sit too quiet for too long.
Right. Well, I think especially if you're Irish Catholic,
yeah,
you know, you have this choice of how do you, because so much of the humor is dark humor, you're really trying to alleviate a lot of the inner pain, and that's what the alcohol is for. So if you're not going to be a drunk, now the humor button really better kick in.
But you saw these Catholic priests who were active.
Yes.
And revolutionary.
Yes.
So you did a year at seminary. Yes. You did a year and a half at University of Michigan. It seems like you're good at taking about a year or so to figure shit out. So
I need to move on.
When did things start to lock in terms of kind of manifesting your revolutionary ideals?
Wow. Well, I put out my own newspaper for about 10 years in Flint. It was called the Flint Voice.
Based on the New York paper?
Yeah, kind of like the old village voice.
Weekly?
Politics and culture and that sort of thing.
Like James Ridgway stuff. You were friends with James, right?
Yes, right, yes. And I ran his column and Alex Coburn's column and, you know, in my paper. But it was after the people that own Mother Jones magazine up in San Francisco saw my paper and asked me to come out and interview to be the editor of Mother Jones. And so I went out there and they offered me the job. and I had to decide whether or not to close up my life in Flint and move to San Francisco.
Did you ever do any radio?
And I had my own radio show in Flint. It was called Radio Free Flint.
What was that?
It was a weekly 1 hour show, something like this. But it had a lot of it had humor, but there were interviews and, on the week of Christmas, we'd have drunk Santa come in and little kids would actually call up live thinking they're talking to Santa. Oh, it was so
mean.
Was
this a late night show?
No, it was not. It was on Sunday morning.
Oh, on a rock station?
Yeah, on a rock station. And you know that rock block before noon?
Sure.
On Sundays where they would have to have community programming?
Oh, right. That was you?
That was me.
Oh, how long did you do that for?
Oh, I did that for almost 10 years.
Really?
Yeah. It was a lot of fun.
Is that where you met James?
No, I met him because he called me up and he said, I'm going to make a documentary film. I have this buddy of mine. His name is Kevin Rafferty in Michigan because there was the Ku Klux Klan and the neo-Nazis were kind of coming back to life.
Was that Blood in the Face?
Blood in the Face.
Oh, that fucking movie fucked me up.
Yeah. And they said, do you know anything about these guys here in Michigan? I said, oh, yeah, I know all about them. Would you help us? And so, yeah, sure. So I got them into like some Klan rallies and some neo-Nazi stuff.
How'd you know that?
I had them on my radio show.
So you would engage these guys?
Oh, of course.
They're scary guys.
No, I go on Bill O'Reilly.
Yeah, right.
I mean, I go on Hannity.
Yeah.
I mean, not that they're Nazis or Klan.
Right.
Don't take that the wrong way. But I'm just saying yes, I'm not afraid of the so-called enemy or somebody has a different opinion than I have.
Right.
But these guys were really crazy.
Yeah.
And so we got there to the big Klan weekend. It was like a convention of Klan. And Rafferty and Ridgway they did not want to be on camera.
Mm-hmm.
They thought after this film comes out, we're dead. And they said to me, would you ask some questions on camera? Like just whatever comes to your head. And I said, yeah, sure. I'm not afraid of these guys. And so that was my first time ever of asking questions on a camera. And a year later, I decided to make my own film.
Yeah.
And I called up Kevin Rafferty and Ridgway. And I said, hey, can you guys help me out and teach me how to make a movie? Kevin Rafferty said he'd made a film called The Atomic Cafe. And
I remember that movie.
That? Yeah,
that was all the old clips and the
duck and cover.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Atomic, he said, I'll come back to Flint and I'll spend a week and I'll shoot for you and I'll teach you how to use the camera and the machine and the sound. And
this
everything.
Is for Roger and me?
For Roger and me.
Mm.
And I knew nothing. And he was my film school. And the most amazing guy taught me how to edit then down in the village when I was done shooting the film. And then I end up in Washington, D.C. because I had to go get a job. And I'm cutting my movie, Roger Me. And it's inauguration day for the first Bush in January of 89.
Yeah.
And I said to the editors, hey, I've never seen an inauguration. You want to go down? Let's go. Yeah, let's.
So it's cold usually.
It's very cold. But we went down. There's nobody there, though, back in those days at the inauguration.
Is that true?
Yeah. I mean, it was like the mall was empty. I mean, it was crowded up by the Capitol steps.
Right.
But it didn't go back like Obama's thing like 3 miles.
Right, you know? Right.
So we got kind of close. And yet there were TV screens. There were big screens that were up. And I said to the editors, oh, my God, there's Kevin Rafferty. He's up there. And we thought he was shooting a documentary of the inauguration.
Yeah.
I called him a couple days later. I said, Kevin, I was at the inauguration of Bush. I could have sworn you were on the stage. And long pause, he goes, yeah, that was me. I said, wow, so were you making a movie or? No, and he's like taking a big drag off his cigarette. And he goes, no, I wasn't making a movie. I said, well, what were you doing up there? Another drag. My uncle is the president of the United States.
Oh my
God. What? I've known this guy for like now 2 or 3 years. I said, you've got to be kidding me. He goes, no, my mother and Barbara Bush are sisters. I said, I cannot. How come you never said this? How come you never mentioned this? He goes, because of the very way you're reacting right now. Oh my God. It was so... I couldn't believe that my film school was a member of the Bush family.
Like a close member.
Yeah, a close member.
Cousin.
So when I get the film done and Bush, George for the first, wants, they're having a family reunion at Camp David, orders a print from Warner Brothers to be sent of Roger and me to Camp David, show, because Kevin helped, he shot the film, right?
So it's like our nephew did the thing.
Kev, our nephew.
Mm-hmm.
So I tried to go, but they wouldn't. I couldn't,
That would have been a good screening.
But I said to him afterwards, I said, so what happened in there on the projection? So it was like, Well, it was pretty quiet during the movie, except for one. Except he said for one of the one of his cousins laughed hysterically throughout the whole movie. I said, "Oh, that's good, 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 good." He goes, "No, no, no, no. He's got a little problem." Yeah. Is his cousin named George?
Oh, he got a kick out of it, huh?
It's the first time I heard of George W. Bush. From whatever high he was on, laughing hysterically throughout my movie at Camp David.
That is a great story.
Is that wild?
It's crazy.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
You know.
That guy who was laughing at your first movie would become one of your mortal enemies.
Yeah. How small is the world?
Small world.
No. No, if I wasn't for the Bush family, I might not even be a filmmaker. That's why I've always spoken well of them. So they're not my mortal enemies.
So you took the job at Mother Jones after Roger and Me?
No, that was how I ended up making the film, because I went out there and 4 months later I'm fired. Mm. Had political disagreements with the owner of the magazine.
Like what?
He wanted to run this story by this guy about the Sandinistas in Nicaragua weren't all that they were cracked up to be, and I didn't feel that way, and he didn't provide the evidence that I required. Didn't like that. I put an auto worker on the cover and gave the guy a monthly column. You know, Mother Jones, like a lot of stuff on the left, was not for working class people.
Right.
And I was trying to change the magazine, I think, more into a working class left liberal magazine. And that's not the direction I wanted to go in.
How do you feel about the left in general? Fired. Yeah. You're fired. But how do you feel about the left in general along those lines, along class lines and along, you know, what activism really means and what is it going to take? What is it going to take for the moneyed left to sort of, you know, integrate and activate and be part of an actual left? Is that something you think about?
I think about it all the time because, well, I'm out here in L.A. right now.
Yeah.
And so I'm going around. I'm showing my movie to people. We're talking about it, but it's
in home theaters.
In home theaters and in other theaters here.
Yeah.
And it's very interesting. I always notice this, especially coming from New York. I can spend 2 or 3 days here,
yeah,
and never encounter in this, especially in this business, African Americans. Mm-hmm. The only African Americans I will encounter in LA will be either picking me up at the airport or serving me something, you know, at a restaurant.
Didn't go to Tyler Perry's house?
I've not been there. No, but it's very...
Yes.
You can't have that experience in New York.
That's
every
right.
Day
That's true.
Is with everybody.
That's true.
And
it's a beautiful thing about New York.
You know, I live on a street that have multi-million-dollar apartments and rent. There's in the building next to mine, there's rent-controlled apartments in there
left.
For $800 or $900 a month. A few that are left, but even that, there's still I don't want to say it's affordable, but if you know how to work it,
yeah,
you can live there.
I've noticed that. Yeah, New York is the tone of the actual island of Manhattan is definitely changing.
Oh, that has really changed. I mean,
like
that's,
you used to really feel like, you know, everybody's on the same page here. You know,
no,
you
know,
it doesn't feel like that anymore.
No, it doesn't. Even like, I mean, I live in a nice apartment building, but when I moved in there, when I first moved in there, there were 2 or 3 guys from Saturday Night Live that lived there. The playwright that wrote M. Butterfly lived there. Harvey Fierstein lived there. 2 New York Rangers lived there. I mean, it was, in terms of the people that had some money and could, you know, afford to live on the Upper West Side, but they were still creative people. They were, my building now is a lot, mostly, I would say majority Wall Street or foreign owners or investors. And I'm like I stick out like such a sore thumb there, and I'm
living in the enemy camp.
I know,
you.
But I bought this place like, you know, 25 years ago. So like the mortgage,
really?
I got the mortgage paid off finally, and it's like I don't want to leave because I, you know, like to get something now would be like outrageous.
How do you stifle yourself walking past your neighbors?
I actually have that thought in my head. Stifle. Now they're probably listening to this and I try to treat everybody the same, but actually it sounds like I pity them because they're bankers, but I guess I do in some ways because they're not doing good for the world. They've made the world, they made this country a worse place. And if I just often think, God, if I had like an hour with them.
You could talk them out of it?
I could talk them out of some of it, maybe.
Uh-huh.
You know?
Well, have you tried? Maybe you should have a little meeting.
I have tried.
Put some posters up. Hey, who wants to talk about the truth?
I have tried. And I try. And I'll tell you something I've done recently. I did this a while back. I was walking out of a movie theater. And this was in Florida. And I walked by a guy. And he just goes, asshole.
To you.
Yeah, to me. And I stopped and I turned around. And I said, hey, you can't call me that. Come back here. And the friend I'm with, she's like, oh, God, what are you doing?
Yeah.
I said, no, it's okay. It's okay. Yeah. The guy comes back, you know, and we don't get into a fight. And he goes, because I think you're an asshole. I said, you don't even know me. How can you even say something like that?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, maybe I am, but wouldn't you want to like at least know something? I know everything about you. I said, you haven't seen a single one of my movies. And he had an honest moment and he said, you're goddamn right I haven't. I said, well, then how can you make up your mind like this without... I said, listen, go home. Seriously, go on Netflix, go on iTunes, rent one of them. I don't get any more money from these films. I don't have a,
right.
a back end.
Yeah.
So I don't. You're not giving me any money. But for $2.99, watch any of them. And I swear to God... At the end of the movie, you may not agree with me politically, but you will come to, I think, three conclusions. Number one, I love this country. Number two, I have a heart. I care about what's going on and I care about other people. And number three, I swear to God, you're going to laugh a half a dozen times in the movie. It's some of it is a comedy.
And what'd he say?
And he said, well, I already know what you're going to say. I said, no, you don't. You honestly don't. You've been told this. By Fox News or by Rush Limbaugh or whatever. Yeah. And they're in trouble once you watch one of my movies because you're going to go, well, they lied to me. I mean, I don't agree with Mike politically, but he clearly loves this country and he's funny.
Well,
and he gives a shit.
Well, how has that burden for you been to sort of be...
He shook my hand.
He did.
He said, I'll do it.
Well, that's it. Well, you treated him with respect.
Because I do respect him. I do. Even calling me an asshole, I think... I'm not mad. I just think he's been misled and that if he really knew me, he wouldn't think.
Well, how do you shoulder that burden of knowing that that's true? That, you know, like, because those guys, a lot of those guys, you could actually, you know, blow at least part of their mind and you could actually, you know, teach them things they didn't know at all. Show them some facts and some truths that elude them because they get their anger buzz from the severely narrow ideology of people that aren't even thinking in their interest.
I know.
So, but how do you live with that?
I mean, how do I handle that? Or
well, I mean, I guess handle it, but I mean that.
You
must
mean handle
be,
the hate or the? Or
there's
the,
a hate, but just being a demagogue of you know, being characterized as this evil demagogue of the left.
Mm.
I mean, because I think this new movie appeals to a broader spectrum
yes.
of Americans,
right?
But there's still going to be those guys who are like, not that guy.
Yes. I can't do anything about the 20% that are over on the far, far right.
Mm-hmm.
They're lost souls. I feel bad about that. They're my fellow Americans. I care about them. And what I always say to them is that I'm going to keep fighting for the things I believe in. And when we succeed at getting true universal health care, when we succeed at having, you know, a bullet train that can get from L.A. to New York in 9 hours, I'm going to let you ride that train, too. And I'm going to let you have the free healthcare too, because I want you to participate in all these things. You know, I'm working on this for everybody, not just myself and my other liberal little do-gooder friends. I am working on these things for all of us. And I, you know, I've actually thought about either making a film or writing a book just for those guys, like, and also for those bankers that live in my building and say to them, I want to explain to you why. These things that I talk about in this current film in terms of the 36-hour work week, the universal health care, a better justice system, not imprisoning people who use marijuana and other mm-hmm. drugs. I want to show
education,
the
premium of a good education.
I want to show you, the conservative, why this is good for you. I want you to agree with this, not because of, again, I don't want you to become a bleeding heart liberal. Stay the way you are. But I want to show you how you will live in a safer neighborhood if we change how we do things, that you will have better employees, smarter employees, if we make our education system different, that you will have healthier employees and they will be more productive if they have a paid vacation, if they have paid maternity leave. I think that there's a way to explain this. If I make it about them, you know, again, go to the me that they so believe in. How does this benefit me? How can I make a bigger profit with my business? Actually, you can make a great profit. There's a reason the French are more productive than we are. I mean, that's a crazy thought, isn't it? That the French are more productive,
right,
work less hours, produce more. How can that be? I'd like to show them how. That if we were more like the French, they would be even richer than they are now.
But what I always found fascinating when I was doing more political talk was just the power of the hypnotic repetition machine, not just the echo chamber, but the amount of money that goes in to sort of mining and exploiting a diminished working class's anger and directing it to really the wrong direction and right, against their personal economic interests, yes, self-interest. Like, it's sort of fascinating to me that there are people that hang on to a sense of pride that is, it's sort of shallow and uninformed at this point.
But I think that's changing too. I think
so, you're right.
We've had Barack Obama elected twice. And I mean, that's an incredible thing. A man whose middle name is Hussein gets elected by a majority of Americans twice. And I mean, we still have so much racism in this country. I think millions of people actually were able to set aside their personal prejudices to vote for him because they knew that was a better way to go than the last 8 years they had under George W.
Bush. And even if they're disappointed for whatever fucking reason,
right,
it was like when I talked to him in here, you know, he talked about, you know, any incremental progress,
right,
within democracy is good.
That's correct. That's right.
And a lot of times it's very incremental, but that's the nature of it. And I was talking to Chris Hayes just about stuff like gay marriage. All the people that had old ideas about those type of relationships who fought it, you know, tooth and nail, you know, in their living rooms, you know, give them a couple of years to be like, ah, that's just the way it is now, I guess. The hate will be gone.
The acceptance
of the reality of democracy working.
That's correct.
Will take hold.
That's right.
That's the way it works here.
That's the way it works. And that's because I think human beings at their core, not everyone, but most, are good.
I do too.
They know good. They know right from wrong.
Yep.
And it doesn't become about Democrat versus Republican or whatever. It's about, you know, what's the common sense thing to do here? What's the fair way to treat people? And I believe most Americans eventually get to that place.
Sure.
Not all.
But there's a lot of things that are keeping a lot of Americans off balance on a day-to-day basis.
Yes. Fear.
Yes.
Fear. What's the percentage of the country that lives from paycheck to paycheck? I mean, it's high. It's really the middle class is less and less. People aren't able to do the things they want to do. They don't know, you know, you can't get your student loan paid off now until you're in your 40s. I mean, yes, the people live with.
Look,
this.
I know people my age that all of a sudden like can't get a job.
And can't get a job.
And they can't get a job.
Right.
I mean, I have people in my family,
yep,
you know, who had jobs and then that, you know, something goes wrong and they struggle. And, you know, these guys are in their 40s and 50s and they're able and they're ready. Can't fucking get work.
Yeah.
It's heartbreaking because there's nothing to fall back on for so many people. There's right, just nothing to fall back on.
Right. And so that will do a number on you.
Oh,
and
yeah, man. Someone's got to pay.
Right.
And it's hard not to think that way.
And it's right. And so the who has to pay for their situation is not the system or the people that have put them in that situation, but
their family, the neighbor, the old boss,
the Mexican,
right,
the whatever.
I think that's right.
I'm going to build a wall. You know, it's like that, you know, Trump really appeals to this sort of that kind of place. Where
it's quite a show. And it's quite a show in a lot of levels. You know, like, you know, from where I'm sitting, that show is really showing, you know, not so much what leadership is in any way, but the sort of like just, you know, deep anger and frustration and sadness and just fear of all of it that whoever is energized by that is experiencing.
Right. But again, remember, 81.5%.
Yeah, I'm not freaking out.
Yeah. Are women.
Yeah.
They're not the angry white guy. They're women. They're people of color. and they're young people. And that's what's going to save us.
Well, from, you know, when looking at the whole oeuvre of your work, if that's the word, you know, going from, you know, all the movies from all the way from Roger and Me and Bowling for Columbine, Fahrenheit 9/11, Sicko. Now, can you cite, you know, outside of what we're talking about now and the electorate changes and some of this stuff, you know, outside, it seems to me that around social issues, we made some progress.
Mm-hmm.
Healthcare, a little progress.
Mm-hmm.
You know, education, not so much.
Mm-hmm.
Race, not so much, a little.
A little, yeah.
But corporate occupation of the government and corporate apologists and corporate malfeasance runs rampant still. And that seems to be the toughest one.
And that's the toughest one. And that is what, if we are destroyed, it'll be because of that, because the democracy will no longer be about one person, one vote, you and I and everybody else having an equal say in what's going on, because we all know now that the corporations, the rich, the 1%, now the 0.1%, it's not the 1% anymore, it's the 0.1%, they call all the shots. They call all the shots with the money they have. They buy the laws. They buy the lawmakers. And if we don't get a handle on that, that will be our doom.
What do you think it will take? See, what, like, I know that when Occupy Wall Street happened, that you were, you know, obviously in support of that, and
yeah,
it was exciting, and it might have made some metaphorical difference. I don't know that it.
Oh, it absolutely, it changed the thinking. It created the idea of the 99%.
Yeah.
Don't have the power. The 1% have the power. That Occupy Wall Street. It, I mean, Obama was talking, was, he took the language of Occupy Wall Street, and when he ran for in 2012, Mitt Romney lost in part because of that tape that the bartender made of him talking about the 47%, the takers,
mm-hmm,
that don't contribute anything.
Mm-hmm.
I think that had an enormous impact on people, far larger than the movement itself wasn't necessarily meant to last, but everybody that felt something about it. I mean, I saw a poll a couple weeks ago. They asked Democrats, your view of capitalism, your view of socialism, which one do you feel? 46% said they had a favorable view of socialism. These are just Democrats, mainstream mm-hmm. Democrats. 46% said they had a positive view of socialism. 37% said they had a positive view of capitalism. That's a transitional moment where that even mainstream regular people realize that the so-called capitalist system that has been operating is not in their best interest.
Well, the one thing I could never understood in having conversations about that, when I did have conversations about that, was this idea of a free market and things finding its level, you know, through privatization. This great, you know, vision of a free market and privatization will provide the best possible education, product, whatever it is. What no one ever accounted for was fucking pathological greed. That there's no way. There's no way a free market can work because of the fucking greed.
Right.
If they're going to undercut whatever they can undercut to save fucking money and make more money. So I just know. And right. Once you take the regulation out, you're fucked.
And part of that is human nature, too.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like we do need regulation.
Of course.
We are told we have to put clothes on when we leave the house.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
it's good not to masturbate in public.
It's yes.
but Michael, so let's talk about this. You're more angry than ever. Yet you were conscious and you had an agenda in approaching this movie, which I tend to think like I'm going to support my own intuition about it. Was that you were dealing with people in other countries and you were excited about it,
yes,
and you were respectful, right, about it.
Yes.
But I thought before we do that real quick, I thought one of the best messages of the movie was this focus on the idea of human dignity.
Mm. Mm.
Like that really fucking hit home for me for some reason. Just, you know, the montage where you were able to cover, you know, prisons and those treatments, the treatment of women, the treatment of just children in the lack of education, school lunches, that the fundamental message of the movie was
human dignity.
Right.
Right.
Did you feel that?
Yeah. Oh my God. Every country we go to, the fact that they're feeding in France, the lunch hour was, that day we were there, lamb skewers over couscous, you know, with some kind of shrimp stew.
Mm.
I mean, stuff that kids would never see here, but they think it's important. It's their children. They don't want to poison them, you know, or that they're, in Finland, the hour-long class is actually 45 minutes, And then after every class, there's 15 minutes of recess. Mm. Every class.
Yeah.
Because the principal says there in the film, these kids have to play. And they got rid of homework. I mean, they essentially, nobody has more than an hour of homework in Finland every night, because they want the kids to be out there socializing, learning, growing.
And also the pace of the education and the engagement with the teachers and the students must be significantly different to sort of have that kind of, you know, confidence that they are still learning, you know, without taking
that. But this issue of human dignity, it's their children.
Mm.
The fact that if you put someone in prison, you have a right, you have a responsibility to treat them right. The fact that Portugal hasn't arrested a single person for using drugs in 15 years, not one drug arrest in this country. And they have the statistics to show that drug use has gone down and crime, drug-related crime has gone down.
And that's with legal drugs.
With, yes, well, it's not legal. It's decriminalized.
Right, that's what I mean, yeah. But that was also, you know, you were able to put that other thing into about, you know, the sort of the maintenance of institutionalized racism through control of the drug trade in urban communities. Like you were really able to sort of, you know, wedge very aggressively and very poignant and disturbing bits of information into this narrative that is a lot more easy to take than usual from you.
Yes.
Like, you know, but, here we are in Norway, and then all, you know, we're dealing with this prison system that is working
right. And
dignified, and then, you know, all it takes is two cuts,
I think,
to footage from American prisons right. Where you're like, holy shit.
Right.
And then the drug thing too, with the Nixon and the civil rights and into the escalation of the prison industrial complex.
All I can say to, because you keep coming back to this question, is maybe I, like all artists, I try to do better each time, and I try to be a better filmmaker. And I've had many people have said, and they've written already about this film, that this is my best film. I don't know if I would say that, because I love all my children equally.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a sense that this film is revolutionary in that sense, that it could reach a lot of people, not on a political basis, but on a human level, and that it could affect change if we started to consider some of the things I'm offering. And I'm offering them up in a kind and gentle way. I do, but I'm doing that for a reason, because I don't, what does it do? How does it get us anywhere if I'm just the old Marc Maron?
good impression.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
No, but you, right.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, I'm just, we haven't followed a similar path, but we are.
Right.
I mean, and my dad died last year. And
how old was he?
It was almost 93.
Good run.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Just died of old age. And it was, you know, and he was a great guy. And
how'd he feel about you and your work?
Oh, he loved it. He loved all of it. Yeah. He was, again, that old Irish Catholic Democrat, Kennedy, mm-hmm. Roosevelt, mm-hmm. all that, you know, World War II veteran, was in all those horrible battles in the South Pacific.
Really?
As a Marine in the first Marine Division. And just
survived it.
You know, that those first 30 minutes of Saving Private Ryan, where they come in the amphibious.
He was in that one?
He was in all of those in the South Pacific. No, not on D-Day.
Yeah.
That was D-Day.
Yeah.
If you were in the South Pacific, that was every month.
Yeah.
I mean, every one of those little islands, jeez, they'd have to go in and they would get mowed down and everybody's dying around you. And I don't know how the hell he and the others came out of that. And he was such a good and gentle soul. And
that was the other thing you got in the movie at the beginning, the opening of the movie.
Yeah.
Was we haven't won a war.
We haven't won a war since my dad and the other dads won that one. And because we really haven't. Let's just be honest. Korea was not a win.
Uh-huh.
The Gulf War,
yeah.
Was Saddam stayed in power.
Yeah.
You know, he was that. Yeah. How do you call that a win when Hitler or whoever?
That was, I think, a slap on the wrist.
Yeah, I mean, it's just that none of these are outright wins since WW2.
There's a weird, like, even when you talk about this, and I remember feeling this when I was at Air America. I'm like, oh boy, there's going to be all kinds of fucking, you know, backlash. You know,
there's going to be a backwash. There's going to be hell to pay for this.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know. We don't want to think about it. I mean, seriously, you and
but
I.
But that's enforced. You know, like I, that's what I, that
it
like,
is enforced.
Because I keep trying to think about, like, who's going to get angry at listening to this right now? And why are they going to get angry?
Right.
Where does that come from? Because like even in the film, you pay respect to service people.
Yeah.
And you know, you're empathetic to their plight, yeah, and the job of that.
Yeah.
Since it's not really a national defense driven armed forces.
Right.
It's a job that people
volunteer.
Choose.
Yeah.
And yet someone's gonna hear you on here and go like, oh, how does he blame us?
Because we invaded these countries and we took out...
Destabilized them.
We destabilized them. They were bad guys,
yep,
but they had their way of maintaining order. Not the way we would like to run it, but it's not our friggin' country. So kill Saddam, remove the Taliban, kill Gaddafi, and look what we've got.
More terrorists.
This is hell to pay. For we didn't know what the hell we were doing. We didn't know how we were mucking this up. For us to like, who the hell do we think we are? Bush didn't know the difference between a Sunni and a Shiite. And we go in there like ignoramuses. We give up the lives of good people. We put our country so far in debt with that war. We were spending $4 billion a week at one point between Afghanistan and Iraq. And, you know, I mean, yes, some people might listen to this and go, you know, oh, he's anti-American. Really? I think the people that put us in this shitty place are anti-American. I think if you supported that war and if you supported going in there and destroying the infrastructure of that country, it's made us less safe. You've made me as an American less safe. And I consider what you did against America and against the world.
Mm-hmm. So what now with this film, the new one?
Did we mention it's a comedy?
Yes, it's always a little comedy in there. The whole conceit is a comedy, but it's powerful. Now, your hope for it is that as many people as possible will see it.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, that is my goal.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I want as many people as possible to see it.
And when you, what do you think is going to happen? When you talked earlier about a revolution in America, how do you think that happened? What do you think happens? What's going to happen in your mind? What do you hope to happen?
I hope that students will start debt strikes, stop paying the student loans. Former students and current students need to protest on campus to get the college at an affordable level. We were 3 states short of passing the Equal Rights Amendment back in the 70s. We only need 3 more states to pass it. Of the 15 remaining that haven't passed it, we just need 3 more. Illinois was one of the states that didn't pass it. We can get those 3 states. We can have an equal rights amendment for women. Women should be paid the same as men. They're doing the same job. They should be paid the same. That's a basic thing. There's some really simple things. You get pregnant, there should be a maternity leave. Not a few weeks off, but literally a few months off, and you're paid. You get paid for this time. I mean, I think there's some things like that can happen. I think that people are ready to. Look at the states that are, most of the states, not Ohio, but most of the states are decriminalizing or legalizing marijuana. They don't think people should be locked up for this. Obama started to let people out of the federal prisons. He's put his toe in the water on that. 6,000 got released in the past month. Hopefully he'll do more of that before he's out of office.
Well, you did good with this movie, man, and I'm glad you came by. It's been a long time since I saw you.
I know it has been a while. I'm really happy for you. I love your podcast. I love the fact that you're on TV.
Just being me.
Just being you.
That guy.
Isn't that funny though? How because I mean I don't know you that well.
Yeah.
But essentially, that is you.
So I think it's a little limited to a little more cranky.
Well, yeah, it's not a documentary. Yeah.
Right.
But
yeah.
But that's okay because you let your inner crank come out in a productive way,
and it's
entertaining.
I've gotten a lot of really amazing things have happened because of this, doing this thing in this garage, but really along the lines of what we were talking about, the most gratifying thing about it is the feedback from people who are troubled. Mm. And, you know, who feel alone in the world or sad or have a drinking problem or, mm. you know, whose depression I ease or who feel less alone. I mean, you know, and I get that stuff every day, and I never thought that would ever happen. And just, you know, just to have that, to feel that, you know, people are like, you know, your conversations about whatever, because they're human and candid and explore struggle with all different types of people, it really make it easier for me to see my own issues and to function better in life.
Well, that's a great way to put, when I listen to you and I see you, I think it's good. It's good for people to feel that they're not crazy. They see you.
Yeah.
They hear you.
Not crazy.
I'm not crazy.
Yeah.
That's good. A good thing.
That is a
Take
good
that
thing.
As a compliment.
That is a good thing. And I think in terms of what you're doing, I think it's sort of a different approach to it, but you're enabling people who I think are crazy to see that they might be misguided.
I hope so. I think so. Wouldn't that be interesting if that happened as a result of this film?
Yeah.
Wow.
You just gotta get more people calling you an asshole on the street and maybe give them the money to rent it on Netflix.
If I could talk to every Fox News watcher who feels that way about me one by one,
yeah,
I think there would be success with a number of them. They may not agree with me.
Why don't you make that movie?
I'm just going just just go,
just going door to door.
Just go door to door in red states.
Yeah. Hey,
red neighborhoods.
What do you think of me?
Yeah.
But why?
Yeah.
Can we talk for, you got an hour? Yeah. Maybe, and then tomorrow I'll come back with a couple films.
Yeah. And, or I could watch my films with them.
Yeah.
You know, see, you're laughing.
Yeah. Yeah. Why did you know that?
Right.
What I just said there?
Yeah. See, I'm a gun owner. You know, you can still be a gun owner. It's okay. You know,
you know what the biggest problem is, Michael, is that, you know, in a world of the internet where people can cherry pick the information that suits their ideology, they can easily say, like, that guy's making that up.
Right.
That's right. The biggest problem. It's like, I've got my truth.
Yeah.
I did a search for it.
Right. Right.
It's
hard. One thing I do to help them, and I've done this for my last three or four movies, I put up on my website when the movie comes out all the factual backup, and I have a rule that it can't be factual backup from The Nation or other lefty magazines.
Right.
So I put an annotated every fact in the film. Here's the backup for it, and it's from a nonpartisan, traditional mainstream source. Mm-hmm. And you can read this and see for yourself that they actually have a lower crime rate in Norway because they don't lock people up forever. There's a point where you over incarcerate and you make your society less safe. You
make monsters.
You make monsters out of them. They come out of the, we have an 80% recidivism rate in this country. They have a 20% recidivism rate in Norway. Just out of your own selfish self-interest to live in a safe neighborhood, wouldn't you want to at least explore how they're doing that?
Yeah. And just, and also that whole other thing that you went through pretty quickly was, you know, the prison industrial complex and its manufacturing arm is disturbing.
It's disturbing. It needs its own movie.
Yeah.
The number of companies that use prison labor, slave labor, to make their products.
It's heavy shit, but it's great to see you.
Hey,
thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me here, Mark. It's been great in this garage, and hopefully when we walk out the door, the Manson cult won't be there.
They're not here.
In the Hollywood
they're
Hills.
They're not here.
I'm in the wrong hills anyways,
If anyone comes to hurt us, they followed you here.
Then if this is Mark's last podcast, I just want to say to all his fans, I'm terribly sorry about this.
Okay.
I meant well.
All right. Bye.
Good night.
See? Just a guy trying to fucking help out. To make it a better place. That's what we all want. Just some of us have different ideas of how to do that. I'm gonna play some fucking guitar. Boomer Lynn!
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.